Today is December 16th, 2006, and this is the Apple Weekly Report, a Mac Observer podcast, and I am Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
This week is all about Blu-ray drives and the flash memory replacement technology that's on its way in the next few years. That is the context machine fodder, and then we're going to do a product roundup with some cool stuff in that. Jeff, start us off.
Okay, we'll start off with a little Blu-ray talk. Dell announced that it has added a Blu-ray 50 gigabyte drive to one of its high-end consumer notebooks, and that laptop starts at $3,670.
Now, you may be wondering why we're mentioning this as the top story of the week rather than, say, blowing past it in the product roundup, or I suppose for that matter, skipping it entirely, because it is, after all, little more than a speed bump to a PC notebook. Whoop-de-freaking-do, right?
Right, but the key to this product is that it has the Blu-ray drive. And we thought this product announcement was a good way to talk about second-generation DVD drives. After all, we'll be hearing about Blu-ray a lot in the next few months, and it probably won't be long before we start seeing it in Macs. So we'll get into some of that in the context machine.
And a new chip technology called phase change storage, developed by IBM and its partners, was recently demonstrated to be 500 times faster and use half the power of current flash memory. The technology could also eventually replace small hard disks.
Phase change memory has advantages over flash memory. Like flash, it is also non-volatile, but so far the testing shows more durability compared to flash memory, which starts to break down after about 100,000 writes. IBM led a team that included Qimonda and Taiwan's Micronics. Customers will have to wait a few years for the technology to become commercially practical.
Now, the story we ran talked specifically about IBM. It's also worth noting that Intel and Samsung are actively involved in the development of phase change memory, called either PCM, phase change memory, or PRAM. I've linked in the show notes to a very helpful Wikipedia entry, and we'll be talking a little bit more about this technology in general and its impact in the context machine. And so let's get into the context machine, of course. We're going to switch things up a little bit. I kind of want to talk about PCM, phase change memory, but Jeff, I want to hear your opinions about some of this stuff, so we're going to kind of switch it up. I'm going to ask the questions for the first part, and Jeff will jump in on the second part. But Jeff, let me ask you about Blu-ray, first of all. Now, there's a format war going on in DVDs right now. Everyone knows about DVDs. It's been this incredibly successful technology. There's been an incredibly rapid adoption of DVD technology. But we're on the cusp of a new generation of DVDs. Give us the sort of 60-second summary here of what this second generation of DVDs is going to be, why we need it, why people are bothering to do it, and then the second half of that, the format war that's in place here. What are the two formats, and what's the setup of that battle?
Okay, well, the reason we're looking at new DVD technology is because the current DVD discs that we use don't hold enough information anymore. And of course, there was a time when people looked at the current crop of discs and said, how could we ever possibly fill up something like that? But then again, I remember looking at my first 1 gigabyte hard drive and saying, geez, how could I ever possibly fill up something like that? So that's part of the drive behind this new technology. And people are also looking for new ways to add interactivity to DVD movie discs. So that's something else that's going along with that. Now, what that's led to is this format war that we're experiencing now. And you could compare it to a degree to the VHS and Betamax videotape wars that we had back in the old dark ages in the 80s. And that's kind of what's happening now, although this time it's over a new DVD format. On one side we have Blu-ray, and on the other side we have HD DVD. And they both have some nice features going for them, and we're just going to have to wait and see how this plays out and which becomes the true standard. Now, on the HD DVD side, one of the great things for that is that it's actually not too difficult to change current manufacturing systems for DVDs to accommodate the HD DVD format. So it costs less to manufacture these discs. The downside is that in comparison, they don't hold as much data. So we get only 15 gigabytes per layer on a disc like this. On the Blu-ray side, costs a little bit more to manufacture because you need to have completely different facilities for the most part, but you can get 25 gigabytes per layer on a disc there. So you can store a lot more on a Blu-ray disc. And now what we're seeing is this whole battle where we have kind of an even division between companies throwing their support into each of these technologies. And for people that don't know, Apple is on the Blu-ray side of this battle. Microsoft is on the HD DVD side.
And in addition to those two companies, there are, I think, Microsoft and Toshiba are the big dogs on the HD DVD side. And then there's actually a very long list of people who are supporting Blu-ray, including Sony and Dell, apparently, and some others. And everyone's kind of picked their side. One of the other things we'll get to in a second, specifically about second generation DVDs, there's no digital rights management encoded, or there's not very flexible or useful digital rights management, DRM, built into current DVDs. And I know that the movie studios are very interested in having DRM built into the second generation of DVDs. Again, we'll talk about that in a second. Now, Apple, you pointed out, is on the side of Blu-ray, so presumably we're going to start seeing those drives in Macs pretty soon. Standard question that someone who follows Apple closely and is accustomed to thinking of Apple as the trendsetter in the PC industry. Dell is shipping computers with Blu-ray drives now. Apple is not. So why is Apple behind on this?
You know, I don't know if it's so much that Apple is behind. I think it's more along the lines of Dell was in a position right now where they could be ahead of everyone else. So okay, so I guess in that respect, yeah, Apple's behind. But I think what Apple I think what Apple is waiting for is to have the manufacturing to the point where they can affordably put the discs or the drives into their computers. And I think that there's a couple other things that they might have going on behind the scenes, deals with other companies that will play out over the next year as we see more of Apple's home entertainment media plan unveil.
So with all of that in mind, what's a reasonable time frame, would you say? Again, knowing that the crystal ball, the TMO crystal ball has been out of commission for way too long, what feels to you like a reasonable time frame?
You know, I'm thinking that we would most likely see Blu-ray drives start showing up in Macs once we start seeing more Blu-ray drives hitting the market in general. And so I'm going to speculate that it'll probably be summer before we see something like that. Although, who knows, Steve Jobs might surprise us in a couple weeks at Macworld Expo and announce a new computer that has a Blu-ray in it.
And it seems reasonable. I mean, one could also envision him standing up and saying, this is going to be the year of Blu-ray DVDs, of second-generation DVDs, and say, we're going to transition our entire computer line to Blu-ray by the end of the year. He's done that on a number of occasions.
Sure.
One time he did that was when he said, this is going to be the year of HD, and people didn't care quite as much as...
Well, that's because they just didn't get what he was really saying.
And what was he really saying?
Well, what he was saying is that he was going to take the Mac product line, and even at the lowest consumer end, he was going to give us the tools to make professional, high-definition productions. And that's exactly what he did. And most people didn't get that's what was going on. And that really is a very big thing, but not a lot of people are really noticing it yet. But when you look back on this over time, people are going to go, okay, now I get what he was talking about.
All right. Now, I want to talk a little bit about DRM here. You talked about one of the major things that Blu-ray is going to let us do, store a lot more data on these discs, make DVDs more interactive. They're also going to include built-in digital rights management. Now, one of the things that occurs to me when I look at the field of the situation for movies right now, you cannot take a DVD and stick it in your computer and hit the import button and get movies into iTunes. iTunes supports movies. iPods play movies now. There are movies for sale on the iTunes store. But you can't import your existing DVD collection into iTunes. Presumably that's because there's no way to do it without making them unprotected so that you can share them with other people. Do you think that's connected to the absence of DRM? Do you think that Blu-ray discs, when they come along, will be supported in iTunes so that you can do that kind of importing, put them on your iPod really easily?
No, I don't think so. And actually, the only reason I don't think that will happen is because the movie studios need to have a way to generate revenue from you copying a DVD to iTunes. And I don't know what mechanism would be in place to make that happen. I think that the technology itself would allow for it. It will just be hobbled because the studios are greedy, greedy, greedy.
Now, let me propose this to you. I can imagine that the studios would say to Apple, you know, we don't want iTunes to do this. And Apple may or may not say, okay, well, we won't do that. Clearly, they haven't so far. Let's assume for the time being that sooner or later, the movie studios will get their content onto iTunes and they're selling it and they don't want to take it off because they're making money off of it. After that happens, does that relieve pressure on Apple since they're no longer courting them, trying to get them in the iTunes store? Does that put Apple in a position where they might be allowed or might feel the freedom, even if it ticks off their partners, they might feel the freedom to go in and include that functionality?
They could, and it might be something that if they went that route, they could have a licensing fee that's built into the movie when you download it from their store. Or you buy an unlock code from the iTunes store, and then you can take your DVD and rip it, and iTunes is keeping a log of what codes or keys you've bought. So, you know, you can go out and buy the Blu-ray or HD DVD version of The Incredibles, go to the iTunes store, buy an unlock code, and then iTunes can copy it over to your hard drive. So you have to pay an extra fee, but I would assume that would be far less than paying for a full download.
Now, all of this, anyone I can hear in the back of my head, our boss, Brian Chaffin, screaming about how this is a violation of fair use. The content is the thing you pay for, not the format that you buy it in. Right now, if you buy a CD, you can import it. You can use that content anywhere you want to. Does it irk you that's something that looks like it's not going to shake out for movies?
You have no idea. I think it's absolutely horrible and is as close to robbery as you can legally get, because they're selling you something and then turning around and taking money from you to use it. That's just lame. I mean, it really is. And I'm sure Brian would have a much more fervid way of saying that.
Fair enough. Shall we switch gears here?
I think that's fair. So now it's time to talk about phase change memory, which, as we said, PCM is one of the acronyms. PRAM is another acronym. So fill everyone in. Tell us more about phase change memory.
Well, phase change memory, first of all, the concept is that you have a material. This is actually kind of a crazy idea. Matter, material, actual like solid material. Most of it is, if you look at the actual atoms inside of the material, they're in this structure, in this very well-ordered lattice structure. Phase-changing materials, if you change the temperature in particular ways, you can cause that well-ordered structure to suddenly become chaotic, to become essentially random. And the thing that's really interesting about phase change memory, or the phase change material, is that its material properties, when it changes its phase, its material properties change, so it conducts electricity differently. That gives you a sort of one, zero, an on-off, true-false difference, physical difference, that you can use to store memory. And if you've never heard this before, if any of the listeners haven't heard this before, the way a computer stores memory is all in terms of ones and zeros, trues and false. It's a binary system. And so you have this binary material that's in one phase or another, and both of those phases are static. So if you cause this phase change, it'll sit in the new phase forever until you change it back to something else. So phase change memory just uses that phase changing effect to store information. Now, PCM means, it stands for phase change memory. PRAM stands for phase changed with a hyphen in it, turn it into one word, RAM, random access memory. And the idea is that you have this memory, just like the RAM that's in your computer, that you can access any bit of phase change memory, just like the RAM in your computer. The difference between the RAM in your computer and PRAM or PCM is that it's static, like flash memory. So when you remove the power, you turn your computer off, the RAM in your computer flushes its contents. You lose all the information there. But flash, the stuff in your iPod Nano or in those little pen drives, that's static memory. It'll stick around for 6 months or so until it then sort of gets corrupted and loses its information. So that's what PCM is.
Okay, so the PCM memory, in essence, when you're using that, you actually have a longer lifespan than you get from the flash memory we're using today. Is that right?
That's my understanding. And the other issue is that flash memory uses little capacitors. It stores charge on little electrodes, and that charge can bleed off of those little capacitors over time. So when you remove the power, it's supposed to hold this charge, but it's not a perfect device, and so eventually it'll lose its information. The phase change is a more durable state than these charged capacitors, and so those will persist longer. The other issue is that they're faster, as we mentioned in the story, and you can alter them more times before the bits go bad, before the memory itself actually breaks. And so both of those things conspire to make it much more useful.
Okay. Now, you also said PRAM, and for everyone playing at home, this is not the same PRAM that you might be familiar with from your Mac.
That's right.
Because we have the acronym PRAM for certain little bits of information that are stored on your Mac that get used at startup. This is a completely different thing.
That's right.
So now I've been hearing people say that we need to wait a while before jumping into the whole PCM thing, and instead of just abandoning flash memory right away and moving on to what looks like the next best thing. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, yeah, so there is definitely a lag time here. And when you go and you look at the stories, Intel, Samsung, IBM are all working on this, and they all have their own partners. And they're shaping up to be a whole new wave of really fierce competition in this business. But when IBM or Samsung or Intel stand up and say, hey, here is a prototype of a PCM card. And in some cases, I think Samsung, I'm pretty sure I saw a press release that Samsung had put out not too long ago, maybe in October or September, that said, we have a 512 megabyte PCM chip, which is really cool, right?
Yeah.
The problem is that in order to build PCM, I mean, you're working with totally different materials, or at least to some degree you are. And so the facilities that you need to use are different, and presumably the manufacturing process is different. This is where my knowledge starts to break down, and people get PhDs in different parts of this process, right? The manufacturing, the science of phase change, all of that stuff. I mean, you could get a degree in any one of those things. And there are a lot of details here that I don't know much about, but all of these companies are going to need to build or modify the facilities they have to begin making this memory in any useful quantity. So that is the primary delay right now. My understanding is that there are working prototypes. People have said, we can do this. We can demonstrate the technology. We just need to ramp up and do it. And because solid-state manufacturing facilities, these semiconductor manufacturing facilities, cost literally billions of dollars. I mean, they cost more than the gross domestic product of small countries. They're incredibly expensive facilities, and it takes a long time to plan them, to build them, to modify the stuff that you already have. So that is the primary holdup right now.
Okay. So instead of evolutionary change in technology we're using, where we really are starting at the ground floor with something new. So have you heard anything about how long we might have to wait before something like this goes mainstream? Because it does sound very cool.
The general propaganda that companies send out tends to say stuff like within the next decade. My sense from the stuff that I read is that people feel fairly confident that by, say, 2010, there will be a vibrant and real PCM marketplace.
So maybe by 2010, we might even be able to see some sort of laptop that can forego a hard drive even.
Yeah. Now, this is one of the critical questions, right? What changes? If you have this new technology, where do you use it? And what are the interesting applications? One of them, what everyone hopes, is that we can throw out our hard drives. That's a very pertinent question for a lot of people. Can we get rid of hard drives? Hard drives, frankly, suck. I mean, they're an extraordinary technology, but they suck. They've got this moving arm that moves at, I'm going to screw this up, but I think it's thousands of miles an hour. I mean, it's like flying a jet plane about a few microns over the surface of the planet. I mean, it's ridiculous what they do with these arms.
It's fracking fast, right?
Right. It's fracking fast. And it's amazing that it works. But the fact is there's still a moving part there, and it still can crash into the surface of the drive, and it's easy to corrupt them. And if you hold a permanent magnet up to it, you lose your data. So it's unfortunate that that's the best technology we have in many respects, not the least because it has moving parts. PCM has no moving parts. It's fast like RAM, but it's non-volatile like a hard drive. And so the hope is that we'll be able to throw out our hard drives.
That would be very cool.
Very cool.
Very cool indeed. All right. So is it time to move on to product roundup?
I think so. The one other thing, obviously, if anyone has questions or comments about this, if anyone has thoughts about these technologies, I know sort of the larger backstory here, but I'd be really interested in if anyone out there knows more about PCM, or if anyone out there knows more about Blu-ray or wants to blow off some steam about second generation DVDs, movie DRM, iTunes, whatever. You can send your thoughts to roundup@macobserver.com.
Okay, then how about let's start off the product roundup this week with the microphone I'm using today, because I am using a different microphone again. So today's microphone comes from Rode, and this is the Podcaster USB microphone. So like all the others I've been testing, it has its own power built in, and it connects directly to my PowerBook through a USB cable. And if you're keeping track of the shapes of these different microphones, this one looks more like, there's the Star Trek episode where Captain Kirk has to fight the Lizard Gorn guy, and he has that little universal translator thing that he has to talk into. That's what are you laughing at?
What?
That's what it looks like.
Oh, well, for those of our listeners who might not be familiar with that episode of Star Trek.
Okay, it also looks like a lightsaber, okay?
It looks like a cylinder. Right?
Well, that's just flat out boring.
That's true. That is pretty boring. I apologize.
Yeah. All right. So it looks like a big cylinder for the boring people. Uh-huh. And for everyone else, you can talk to Gorns with it. All right.
All right, so it's a USB mic. You don't need, at my end, as I've been pointing out to people, I have this M-Audio audio interface that I use to plug microphones in my Mac. You plug it directly into your Mac. How was the setup? Was it pretty easy to get functioning?
It's just as easy as all of the other USB microphones I have tested. I plugged it in, selected it in the sound system preferences pane, and that was it. So now this one, the company says they also have their own software for enhancing the performance of the microphone. And I like just jumping in and see how something works. So I haven't installed their software yet. So I'll be playing with that over the week, and we'll see if that actually makes any difference. But so far, it seems to be performing pretty well.
I will say a couple of things just from my end, where we record the show. First of all, we've got a great Skype connection. And Jeff, just from listening casually as we're talking, I think your voice sounds lovely.
Why, thank you.
The level that you're getting out of this mic is much, much lower than the level that we were getting out of those two condensers that you used before. Now, this is a dynamic mic. The other two were condensers, the Snowball and the Samson CO3U.
CO3U.
Those were condenser mics, and they got a lot more volume out of them. This one is much quieter, but at the same time, you sound good. And I had to crank things up a little bit at this end, but by and large, it's been pretty straightforward to record you.
Well, maybe the Rode software will give us some more punch out of this microphone. We'll know next week.
All right, and this is about $200 if you look at the online retailers. Kind of an interesting thing, a high-end, dynamic USB microphone. They say broadcast quality, and it sounds, when I'm listening to your voice, it sounds good. You sound good. So
excellent, and it's heavy. I mean, I could hurt someone with this if I wanted to. So if you get one, make sure that you have a microphone stand that is weighted or balanced well enough that it will hold this microphone.
Fair enough.
Yes. Okay, so now we can talk about something that I find very exciting. Okay, not that microphones aren't exciting, but this is exciting in a different way. Photoshop CS3 public beta from Adobe. And since I've spent so many years in the graphic arts industry, this is something that I do get excited about. So now we have a public beta for Photoshop that came out on Friday afternoon, and this version runs natively on Intel Macs, so we finally have, at least in a beta version, a universal binary of Photoshop. And it has a lot of really great features in it. We'll talk more about that later. But it's out there. If you are using Adobe Creative Suite 2 or Photoshop CS2, and you have a valid serial number, which I'm sure you all do, then you can go to labs.adobe.com and you can download the Photoshop CS3 public beta, and Adobe will give you a serial number for your version. You can play with it, and it will run, presumably, all the way through to when Adobe releases the actual finished CS3 product, which last time they've been saying is spring.
All right, spring of 2007.
Yes. Oh, and another thing, as long as I'm on my Photoshop kick, Adobe has never done anything like this before. So this is an unprecedented event, really. And I think a lot of what's behind the motivation to bring this out now is that people have been clamoring since day one of the Intel transition for a native Photoshop so they can get the performance they need.
All right. And just a couple of other little product news things from the week. Echo FX announced the immediate availability of Video Glide 1 on Friday. Video Glide is a universal binary app that supports video capturing from USB 2-based video digitizers. The software also supports simultaneous recording from multiple devices, offers accelerated full-screen playback, duration-based recording, and AppleScript support. It costs $30. And also this week, Misha Sakalaroplo reviewed the DryPod for the fifth generation iPod. And Jeff, you reviewed Burning Monkey Solitaire 4.
Which was fun. And that's all the news. Thanks for listening to Apple Weekly Report. And let me apologize right now if you've been hearing clunks. I'm getting used to this new microphone. I keep leaning over and bouncing my glasses off of it. Sorry.
Our content is written by the fine people at the Mag Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom. That's all I got.
And even though I can't keep from bouncing off of microphones, stay subscribed.
Until next week, everyone, we'll see you online.